You want to put it in front?
How about from here?
Right here.
Oh, well, you know, I made a vow many years ago that I would not get involved in politics. Yesterday, I began to dig my... I'll mention briefly what I talked about. Actually, it does fit in with Tanakh a little bit, too.
Let's see how you do this one.
I really make 2 points. One is the question of to what extent is personal morality relevant in choosing a political candidate? So one thing to look at is the interesting kasha the Rishonim ask. The Rishonim ask the question, how come when Shaul committed one Aveira, he was supposed to wipe out Amalek, and he didn't wipe out Amalek. So Hashem says immediately, that's it. One chance and no more. And when David committed the sin with Bathsheba, which is a very serious Aveira, granted the Gemara says it wasn't adultery and murder, because really Uriah HaChiti had given Bathsheba a get, and Uriah was liable for Misa because he didn't obey David's orders, but nevertheless, certainly in spirit, it is considered. I mean, the Nach says it's murder and adultery and everything else, and David is given another chance. Why is that? So I said there are three answers that are given, and the answers have differing implications on this issue. Answer number one that's given is that although David's chait may have been worse, even, we look at how they respond when they're confronted with evidence of their wrongdoing. If you remember in Shmuel, Perek Tesvav, every time Shmuel tells Shaul, you know, why didn't you do this? So Shaul first says, well, I did. I took care of everything except one little thing. You know, how bad is that? And then Shmuel says, well, I hear the sheep, and what's going on? So Shaul says, well, people made me do it. So sometimes Shaul denies he did something wrong. Sometimes he blames other people. And David, when David is confronted with Nasan, the Navi, the famous parable, so Nasan just tells him, David says, Chatasi, I've sinned. He offers no excuse, he offers no rationalization, he immediately admits his guilt. So many Rishonim learn that it's not that a chait disqualifies you, but the ability to admit to a wrongdoing is really very, very significant. Of course, as I mentioned, in this case, this offers you no choice because both people are equally guilty of basically never admitting their mistakes, never acknowledging their wrongdoing. So that factor can go in different ways. But then there's another distinction that the Sefer Ikarim says, and this is fascinating. Sefer Ikarim, you know, lived in the 1500s.
Who's
this? Sefer HaIkarim, Rav Yosef Alba, medieval Jewish philosopher. He says there's a distinction between personal morality and political morality. He says very specifically, he says, Shaul's sin involved the violation of his duties as a king. As a royal, his royal responsibility was to eradicate Amalek, and he did not eradicate Amalek. That was a job, a governmental thing. The sin was the passion that any individual could fall into. It was a sin of a personal nature. And a sin of a personal nature does not disqualify one for government, for malchus. It only has to be a sin involving the way you carry out your duties. Again, that has, again, interesting implications as to the distinction. Again, I'm not endorsing anybody. I'm not interested in that. But there's an interesting distinction between, you know, the type of sin where somebody had a mistress and the type of sin where somebody, you know, was engaged in various arms deals or the like, which were improper, that one is not necessarily a disqualification. There's a third answer that some commentaries give. And they say that in every Aveira there are two components. There's the sin itself, and then there's the Chilul Hashem that is created by the sin. The impression people get and the fact that Hashem and his Torah is brought into disrepute. So he says very interesting, he says Shaul's Aveira was a public sin. All of Bnei Yisrael knew that Shaul did not carry out the command of God. David HaMelech's sin, if you think about it, we know about it because it's publicized in the book of Shmuel. But if you think about it, the average Jewish person did not know that David committed any sin. I mean, they weren't aware of David being with Bathsheba before he married her. As far as they know, or he was a soldier who got killed in battle.
Well, unless you take the Midrash that Yoav showed the letter around to everybody.
Well, okay, that's right. But according to the simple meaning of the Psukim, there was nothing that anybody had to know other than the people immediately around David. So the concept is that there was less of a Chilul Hashem in David's Aveira. than there was in Shoals of there, and therefore for the Chilul Hashem involved, Shoal had to lose his monarchy. Again, how that cuts is you know, again, I'm not sure which way that would cut. So that was one thing I was talking about, the idea of the, but at least according to one explanation, the personal morality is not necessarily disqualification for Malchus. And then the other issue I just was addressing, people had asked me to talk about this, the question six on the Maryland ballot, which is the abortion issue. A few people asked me, so I was reading different newspaper columns, and part of the problem with the columns is that, you know, you have a column written by somebody who's an advocate of the change, and you have a column written by somebody who's against the change, right? They debate it. But, you know, you're reading two different versions of what the law says, apparently, so I wanted to actually read the actual law itself. Now, even in the ballot, in the voting booth, you're not going to see the law itself. Question six is a paragraph. The law itself is three or four pages in the statute book, so it really is a long thing. And, you know, you can only get that basically in a law library, like, which I'm fortunate to have access to. So I did look up the law. Let me just, again, if people want to hear just the general information, then I'll tell you about, I think, how one would approach this. Maryland has an abortion law dating from 1968. The 1968 Maryland abortion law is not totally against abortion. It only permits abortion if there's a threat to the mother's life, a threat to the mother's health, or some severe psychological stress as determined by a doctor, which meant it wasn't that difficult to get an abortion, even under this old law, but basically that's what it said. And it required that abortions be performed in licensed hospitals, and it also required, in the case of a minor, parental consent. That is what the old law says. Now, that old law was probably unconstitutional after the Supreme Court said there's this constitutional right to have an abortion, but the old law was never repealed, so it was an unconstitutional law that is on the books. In 1991, because people figured that the Roe versus Wade business would be thrown out, and that would bring back the 68 law, so people who were pro-abortion wanted to pass this new law, which would make it much more liberal. And this new law is up for referendum now. So the way it works is this. If the new law is approved, that's going to replace the 68 law. If the new law is not approved, we will have that 68 law, which is unconstitutional, but it's likely to become the law if Roe versus Wade is overturned. Now, what does the new law say? So the new law says, number one, it says before a pregnancy is viable. That means before a baby could survive outside of the womb. That's really the first 6 months, basically. Abortion is permitted for any reason. In other words, you don't have to show any reason anymore. After viability, we go back to the old standard of life, health, and psychological stress. So it guarantees the right of abortion before viability. It also repeals the need for an abortion to be in a hospital. You have to have just a licensed physician. And it says parental consent is not necessary if, among, number one, there's a chance of abuse, which, okay, that I think makes sense. Let's say there was actual incest or something. But then it says something, or if the doctor feels that the minor is mature enough to make the decision on their own. Which it says, if the doctor feels the 14-year-old is mature enough, you don't have to tell the parents. All right, so we have these two abortion laws, the 68 law and the 91 law. And the question is, al pi halacha, is there any particular obligation we have to vote one way or the other? Now, you know, I remember in Eretz Yisrael, before every election, Rabbi Neuberger used to put up the candidates we were supposed to vote for. You know.
He still does.
This is who you're voting for. I'm not going to do that. But I just want to tell you some of the perspectives, because generally it's very important to know about a lot of these issues. Because, you know, I think we're really torn. From people are very, very torn in an election like this in particular, because it's fair to most people, not everybody, but that in terms of Israel and the like, many people would feel a Democratic Party is better. On the other hand, Democratic Party embraces a whole bunch of social issues that religious Jews don't necessarily agree with. So people are kind of torn between two evils. Again, the basic halacha of abortion is fairly clear. The halacha of abortion for non-Jews is actually stricter than the halacha of abortion for Jews. Jews are not allowed to have abortions or perform abortions, but if they do so, it's not considered murder. It's not a capital offense. Killing of a fetus is not something for which you are chayav misa under Torah law. Nevertheless, under Noahide law, under the seven laws of Noah that govern non-Jews, it is considered to be a capital crime. And indeed, it was in yesterday's parsha. When it says in the verse, Shofech dam ha'adam be'adam, he who spills the blood of a person in a person. So Chazal say that literally means killing a baby, killing a fetus. Damo yishafech, his blood shall be spilled. So the Gemara says in Sanhedrin, I think Daf Nun Zion, that Bnei Noach neharag al ha'ubrin, a Ben Noach is killed, under Torah law would be killed for performing an abortion. So Noachide law is stricter than Torah law. Torah law means as applicable to Jews. Now then we have this question. To what extent do I, as a Jewish person, have an obligation to ensure or to take steps that Noahide principles be respected? Now clearly, if you look at these two laws, the 68 law is closer to what the law of Ben Noach is than the 91 law, because although 68 law is not totally the same, because 68 law permits abortion, let's say, for psychological stress and the like, which may not rise to pikuach nefesh. Halakha recognizes psychological stress, but it generally has to be something along a life-threatening situation. But nevertheless, it is closer. So does that mean I have an obligation to vote for a law which is closer to Torah principles than not? Well, the Rambam says in Hilchos Melachim, an interesting rule, the Rambam says, it talks about the Ger Toshav. The Ger Toshav is the non-Jew who wants to live in Eretz Yisrael. And in order for a non-Jew to live in Eretz Yisrael, the non-Jew has to accept the seven commandments of Noach. Right? There's such a thing called the Ger Toshav. Now, what if the non-Jews who are living in Eretz Yisrael have not established a court system to adjudicate these laws? So the Rambam says the Jewish community has an obligation to establish courts that will enforce Noahide law as against non-Jews. Those courts could either be Jewish judges, if you can't find qualified non-Jewish judges, or ideally they could be non-Jews who have become specialists in Noahide law. There is a concept of a non-Jewish rabbi, so to speak, who is the posek of B'nai Noach laws. So what the Rambam is that Jews have a responsibility, at least in that particular context, to try to see that Noahide law is enforced. So on its face, that would be an argument that one should vote in favor of any law that is more closely corresponding with Noahide law. Again, I do want to emphasize that the Noahide issue is crucial here, because we certainly have no obligation to ensure that non-Jews keep the Torah as a whole. So I don't have to push, as it were, that Torah principles be enshrined. But the Rambam is saying I may have to push that Noahide principles be enshrined. So the pashtus would be to be in favor of, against question 6, to go back to the 67 law. And that's probably, if I had to make the decision, that's probably where I would go. That's, where I would go. But let me just present the counter-argument, because there is a counter-argument that you can grapple with. I'm just going to confuse you, because I'm not going to give you an answer on this, but I'll just present the other side of the coin. And that is, the Rambam is talking about a situation. The Rambam is hypothesizing a halachic government in Israel. In other words, a religious government in Israel that is obedient to halacha, where the non-Jewish courts would be under this Jewish supervision and would be applying halachic principles. Now, when you have the state of Maryland passing a law that happens to coincide with halacha in some respects, they are not going to apply halachic definitions. They're not going to consult a rav or a posek as to what is pikuach nefesh, what is psychological stress, what is this and that. They will be applying secular standards, which may or may not be the same as Jewish standards. It is conceivable, it is theoretically possible, for example, maybe it's not a serious risk, but it is theoretically possible that under a very tight anti-abortion law, the state would prohibit an abortion that halacha requires a woman to have, based on, right? So you really can't compare the Rambam's now. The Rambam is talking about where Noahide law will be enforced under the definitions of halacha, under the definitions of Sheva Mitzvos B'nai Noach. But to use a secular arm to enforce religious principles when they're not going to apply religious definitions could create a tremendous danger for the Jewish people. And again, you're opening up a whole floodgate. Generally, to use a political process for religious law is very dangerous, because if you use religious principles, let's say, to pass a strict anti-abortion law, then people could use cruelty to animal things for shechita. Even now there's a fear that because of recent Supreme Court decisions that they could pass a law saying that no minors, there's already a law that says, well, minors cannot have alcoholic beverages. There's a religious exception, but under recent Supreme Court decisions, they could eliminate that, and they could say, as long as it's a general law, they could say, can't. So one argument why, what I'm saying is, in effect, is that it's theoretically possible that although Jews are unequivocally opposed to, religious Jews should be unequivocally opposed to abortion on demand. There's absolutely no issue that abortion on demand is wrong, but politically one can say, I don't want the states, I don't want a secular body to enforce this. Just as, for example, it's wrong to be Mechal Shabbos. It's wrong to eat treif. But, I wouldn't want the state of Maryland to pass a law. We used to have blue laws, right? Let's say the state of Maryland would pass a law that says every person must have one day of rest a week. Christians can do it on Sunday, and Jews must do it on Shabbos. So let's assume that somebody is whatever it is. So let's say the Attorney General of Maryland doesn't like the concept of a blech. So the Attorney General comes in and says, you are cooking on Shabbos. The Shulchan Aruch says, with the blech and everything else you can do. This. Well, we don't think so. We regard this as an infringement of the day of rest. You see the thing here. In other words, once you have a secular body that is not accountable to any halacha enforcing things that we happen to like, it could easily work the other way. So theoretically, a pro-life philosophical stance would be in favor of a pro-choice legislative stance. It's a subtle point, and when politicians say it, they get in trouble because the press tends not to understand that.
Is that why the Aguda came out for the abortion law?
In Maryland?
No, in general.
Well, Aguda took a stance in a similar thing. They didn't want necessarily to have a lot of legislative restrictions on abortion. So that's one argument. I still think that given the fact that Maryland's law under the 68 is already liberal enough that it won't interfere too much, at least symbolically it's probably better to have a law that at least respects life on its face than not. But I think there is an argument generally.
Can I ask you something? If you feel that you're voting wrongly in some way, that this is, it's got some but attached to it,
right,
in terms of your halacha, what, this may fly in the face of these advertisements that tell you you must vote, but would you maybe not do, you just don't vote because you may be voting something that's not halachically correct? I mean, who says you have to vote? Yes or no?
Well, that's true, but again, if you abstain, the decision will be made one way or the other, and the question is, not voting is action as well. It's not like not doing it. I should also say, too, that even as a matter of, again, the parental consent thing, I think you have to think about, too. I mean, even if you believe philosophically in, that there shouldn't be legislative encroachment, the parental consenting is a very big issue. Although I would point out that according to halacha, girls who are minors under American law are actually adults. I mean, so by definition, unless someone who's less than 12 getting pregnant, which is not, it's not a realistic fear. I mean, it's possible, but that's not what the problem is. So theoretically, all of these minors are in fact adults in the eyes of halacha. But
But the question the specific point that you're arguing in regard to question 6 is
right.
Not the question. It's a very different question than the stance between Bush and Clinton on the issue nationally.
That's right. That's right.
I mean, you're arguing a very specific, narrow definition.
I'm arguing on the state, on the state level. That's right.
Right.
That's right.
It's a
that's
state
right.
level, and
that's right.
You can't transpose
and
that
in
argument
fact,
to the national.
Well, yes. In fact, that is a defense of Roe versus Wade. In other words, the defense of Roe versus Wade would be that this is not a matter where we want state governments to have the ability to impinge on religious matters. In other words, one can actually be in a good person philosophically and say, I want states to have no business in this, which is a defense of Roe versus Wade, but not because of the pro. Again, the pro-choice arguments, again, we have to emphasize over and over again, are totally offensive to a Jew. And it's unfortunate that the most articulate proponents of these arguments are always Jews. Everybody in the world thinks the Jewish position is unabashedly a pro-choice position, and that's a Chilul Hashem that we have to dispute. But disputing a position philosophically does not necessarily translate into having prohibitions enacted by a secular body. And the other argument, once again, is if you pass a tighter abortion law, are you in fact cutting down on abortions, or are you driving, you know, the so-called back alley? Now, if your net effect will not be to cut down on abortions, then that's yet another argument that you're not mechuyev to tighten up. Again, on balance, I would think to vote against Proposition 6, to give you a bottom line, but one can make a religious argument to the contrary. So it's a very complicated issue.
Under notified law, are you allowed to have her perform an abortion in case of threat to the mother's life?
It's an argument. Actually, some say the Noahide law is so severe that there's no permissibility at all. Others will allow the same permissibility as for a Jew. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm saying the old American law is not fully Noahide. And even if you permit Pikuach Nefesh, Maryland was never, or at least since 68, Maryland has not been an anti-choice state. I mean, it's limited it. But it did require stress, some extenuating factor. But a doctor could determine that, so it wasn't that difficult to get a legal abortion in Maryland since 68. All right. Okay, that's it, my political recommendations.
I'm surprised that Maryland seems to be going to Clinton.
Well, Governor Schaefer went for Bush, didn't he?
I don't know, your first argument sounded to me like an argument for corrupt. Is it too high?
Corrupt is a pathological liar.
That's right.
Maybe he's not. Maybe he's just sick. He's not a Catholic.
Are you allowed to elect
them?
The states want the right to be able to choose, not have to follow.
See, another thing, I think something like, if you take another controversial thing that arises a lot, you know, various gay rights laws and things like that. That, in a way, to me at least, is a much, much easier issue than abortion, because to have a law that permits abortion is a law that essentially permits violations of the Torah. So at that point, we have to consider, well, maybe you want to hand the state not to get involved. But something that simply extends employment rights. You know, the Torah doesn't say if people are homosexual, you know, they lose their jobs. In other words, a gay rights law is not something that is frontally violating the Torah, at least if it's simply so. So that actually is a much easier thing to support.
It's considered an abomination.
The act is an abomination, but, you know, once again, it is forbidden. Again, it is clearly forbidden. But what I'm saying is that there's nothing in the Torah that says people who sin should lose their jobs or whatever. I mean, the Torah says there are certain punishments that are given. We don't have the power to administer them today.
I thought they were pretty strict about that, ostracizing them. Not really.
It doesn't. There's. You can ostracize people who don't keep Shabbos and don't keep kosher. I mean, there are a lot of things you could do, but if we don't do it for those, there's not necessarily something to do for that. I just read there was Oregon apparently has something up for referendum that says, an amazing thing that says, schools or something shall try to discourage homosexuality, something like that. So a lot of the people are saying, well, it's a violation of civil liberties. So some rabbi from Brooklyn traveled all the way to Oregon to lead this one-man campaign to support this amendment. But it's little. Right.
There's also objections to people, some of the materials that they're bringing into the schools where they present family relationships.
No, that's a real,
relationships that
yeah.
Supposed to cover.
No, a very, very serious problem is the fact that everything is now made, equally valid alternative lifestyle.
Yeah, that bothers me when it goes into laws. You know, that's and not to follow your own. Religious conscience.
I mean, that's really the general problem. I was mentioning we have these two models of how to relate to the world. So we have Noah, who, when he was confronted with a corrupt world, separated himself and built a tower. Mm-hmm. Now we have Avraham Avinu, who went out to try to influence the world. So the truth is, you could say, in some sense, it's not really true, you could say, well, the Republicans are like a Noah. They build an ark and kind of look at the rest of the world and say, you know, you're out. You know, Avraham, who opens his arms and embraces. But the emphasis is, it's not really true, because Avraham embraced everybody, but with the purpose of bringing them to a higher recognition. He didn't embrace the idolaters and say, oh, what you do is fine. So really, the truth of the matter is that we have to be like an Avram of embracing and welcoming, but not just welcoming and saying, oh, you know, every possible shita is equally valid, but in terms of the notion of trying to bring a morality to the room. Okay. Anyway, we're up to Perek Vav. Let me just give you a few more observations from Perek Hay. If you remember, Perek Hay, we read about the Jewish people having a bris milah and the problem of not being able to eat matzah that first year because they didn't bring the korban of the Omer. I'll just mention a famous question. The Gemara in Chulin says, based on the pasuk in Parshas Ekev, where Hashem says, you will come into the lands and you will find batim maleim kol tuv. You will find homes that are filled with all sorts of goodness. Asher lo milesa, that you didn't fill. And you'll find all sorts of wealth, and you'll become arrogant, and you'll forget Hashem, so Hashem says, don't forget me. But the Gemara has a drasha in Chulin that whatever the Jewish people found when they entered Eretz Yisrael, they were allowed to eat, even if it was kitle de chazire, that means the tongues of pigs. In other words, for the 14 years, or at least for the 7 years, 7 years of battle that they waged to conquer Eretz Yisrael, they were allowed to eat forbidden food. They were allowed to eat tref. This was a heter because they're involved in Mochames Mitzvah, in the obligatory war of eating of conquering Eretz Yisrael. So the question is, if there is such a heter of kitlei dechazire, of eating non-kosher food, then what was their problem with eating the grain? When they, right, remember, they couldn't eat the grain till the 16th of Nisan because it was Chodesh and there was no Omer sacrifice. But so what? They could eat Chazir. Why couldn't they eat? Why couldn't they eat the grain? So the Emes is, there is an argument between Rambam and Ramban as to the scope of this heter. Rambam says it's very limited. Rambam says it's not really a heter at all. It's really a pikuach nefesh situation. That if you're fighting a war and there's nothing to eat, you can eat treif. In fact, they even ask, so why does the Gemara have a drasha? I mean, why does the Gemara make it into a new principle if it's just pikuach nefesh? But if it's only pikuach nefesh, so obviously they still had their man. If they still had their man, there was no pikuach nefesh involved. But Ramban says, no, Ramban says, even if they have kosher meats, for those 7 years, the prohibitions against eating non-kosher food were annulled. Ramban does not say it depends on that. They had their man till the 16th of Nisan, till the day they were able to eat the grain. Okay? That's exactly it. So, consequently, they don't need to eat something you're not allowed to eat. But Ramban doesn't condition it that way. Ramban in Parshas Ekev says this is an absolute heter. It's strange to understand why there would be such a heter. That's what he says. So then the question becomes, why did they have a problem eating the Chadash? So, I mean, there are a number of answers that are given. Some want to say that anything which will eventually become permitted automatically anyway. In other words, if something is usher and will never be mutter, so you're allowed to eat it. If something will become mutter, so the Torah expects you to wait a day. But in truth, you can actually make an argument the opposite way. Something that's totally treif is it should be worse, maybe, but this is a ha'ara that people ask on the Ramban, that this seems to be a proof to the Rambam, that unless there's a sakana involved, there was no dispensation to eat treif.
You know how I took this to mean that they were not necessarily eating anything treif, but eating natural foods, which they did not have.
Since no, I understand.
Settled in the land,
I understand.
So they were allowed.
No, but they weren't.
Fruits and vegetables, things like that, would be okay.
No, but it does say that they could not eat. They could not eat the grain. See, normally in Eretz Yisrael, you cannot eat the grain of the new year till the Omer sacrifice is brought on the second day of Pesach.
Well, I could see not the grain, but I could see where they could sustain from the grain by eating the fresh.
Well, or they had the
natural
man.
Food.
They actually had their man from heaven too. They didn't even need natural food. They had the man.
Yeah. Maybe now they could have a little more than just the monitor.
But they still have to wait. They had to wait that day. Let me just give you another observation. If you remember, at the very end of the Perek, we had an angel that confronted Yehoshua. And the angel basically had his sword out, and Chazal say, because the angel was criticizing Yehoshua either for separating men from their wives or for not learning Torah, etc. And Yehoshua took off his shoe, because he says this is holy land. First of all, there is an interesting idea here that there are four places in Tanakh where there's a description of an angel coming to a person. One is, of course, the encounter with Yaakov and the angel. Right, the night before Yaakov meets Esav, he wrestles with an angel. Two is Manoach. Manoach was the father of Shimshon. And the angel came to Manoach to tell Shimshon, tell Manoach and his wife that they were going to have a son who would be a great hero. Three is another Shofet, Gilad. Gilad waged war against the Midianites. And the fourth is Yahushua, right here. Now, an interesting observation that is made is, sometimes you find, when people are confronted with this mysterious angel, they demand to know the angel's name. If you remember, Yaakov had a whole point. Yaakov says, you know, what is your name? And the angel said, Lama Shal Lishmi, why are you asking my name? My name is Peli, which means my name is concealed and hidden. Manoach asked for the angel's name. But Gilad and Yahushua did not. Gilad did not ask for the angel's name. By the way, just if I can digress for a second, there's a beautiful thought Rav Shvedran says. He says, you know, Yaakov asks the angel, what is your name? And the angel says, Lama ze tishal lishmi? Why do you ask? So most of us interpret that to mean the angel's not telling him. But Rav Shvedran says, that's the angel's name. The angel's name is, why do you ask? How does that work? He says, he says, because this angel represents Esav, the powers of evil in the world. And evil has a hold over us because we sometimes don't ask what it really represents. We get involved, let's say we watch television for hours, we kind of get into a stupor or a trance, and we don't really think about where we're doing. And when we don't think about what we're doing, so we get caught up in all sorts of meaningless things. So the angel says, you want to know what my name is? My essence is, don't ask. Because when you don't ask, that's when I have power over you. If you ask, then I don't have power over you. That's actually the angel's name. But anyway, on this observation, how come two out of the four asked for the angel's name? And two not.
Did Avram have a confrontation
By the Akedah, you mean? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right. The three angels. Except over there, remember, that's true. The three angels came to him in the guise of Arabs. Uh-huh. If you remember that the angels came as guests. Also by the Akedah. By the Akedah, an angel called Al Tishlach Yadchel Anar. That's right. It's a good point. But as I say, the first encounter, they came in the image of people. And in the second encounter, a malach called from him. The malach did not appear before him.
So in these four cases, they were seeing angels.
Right, the angel appeared before him as an angel. As an angel.
But here it says Ish. Isn't that Ishamim? So the vision that Yahushua had is of a man.
Yeah, but the man then revealed himself to be an angel, and then Yahushua perceived an angel. In other words, angels take on forms, because angels don't have any natural form. But Yahushua thought it was a man, but then the angel revealed himself as an angel, and he has an angel that is standing fully in front of him. So one of the Svarim, there's a Sefer Niflos Mitoras Hashem, which is written around 150 years ago, and he tries to show how many of the events in Nach are foreshadowed in the Chumash, his prophecies in the Chumash. So he says, like as he says, that when Yaakov blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, Yaakov said, Hamalach HaGoel Osi Mikol Ra, the angel that has saved me, Yivarech Es HaNa'arim, shall bless the Na'arim, shall bless the youths. Now the youths are Ephraim and Manasseh. So it was known, and now also Yahushua, who is a descendant of Ephraim, is often called a Nar in the Torah. It says Yahushua is the Nar of Moshe. And Gilad, who is from Manasseh, is also called a Nar. And therefore the concept was that when Yahushua and Gilad saw the angel, they had no cause for surprise or concern, in effect, because they knew this was a fulfillment of Yaakov's blessing of Yivarech Es HaNa'arim. Masha'en Ken Manoach. And who's the other one? Manoach and
Yaakov.
Yeah, Manoach and Yaakov, right. They didn't have that advanced bracha, and therefore they were wondering what's going on. That's what he wants to say. Okay. Also, one little har on taking off your shoes. It says what? Take off your shoe, because the land in which you are standing on is holy land. Why was it particularly holy? That's a question, right? This is Yericho. Why is it holier than any other part? So really, some of the Mefarshim want to say this. What Hashem is telling Yehoshua is, the truth of the matter is, the Yad Mas Kodesh is all of Eretz Yisrael, not this land. All of Eretz Yisrael is so holy that you should never wear your shoes when you're in Eretz Yisrael. But given the fact that that might be impossible, so as a symbolic gesture, as you cross the Yarden and you're standing in front of the very first city, take off your shoes to have a sense, a perpetual sense, of the holiness of the land that you're on. So it's not even referring to this spot. The Admas Kodesh is all of Eretz Yisrael. And there were...
Why one shoe?
I mentioned that, this explanation doesn't fit in that well. The other explanation is that Moshe, who perceived the totality of the Shekhinah, took off both shoes. Yeshua's vision was less. But if it's not going on the vision, it doesn't explain that. But, you know, there are people who, they don't spit. They will not spit on the ground of Eretz Yisrael. They will not. They have to, whatever it is, they'll spit into a handkerchief. But they will not do anything. They will not do anything on the ground that is considered to be disrespectful to the ground, because the ground itself is in a status of holiness.
It's interesting. You're supposed to take off your shoes to connect holiness, but can you dive in? You can't dive in without shoes, right? You have to.
It's an interesting question. Well, no, it is interesting. If the minhag of the place is to take off your shoes, for example, in many of Sephardic shuls. They dive in barefoot. It's proper to be barefoot if it's a sign of reverence. See, the key basically is, it becomes a question of convention, because the key is you have to go to dive in the way you would approach a king. And that depends. And that's societally determined. It's not the halacha so much. If a king, they wouldn't go barefoot, so you have to wear shoes. It is interesting that in the Harabayas itself, one should basically go barefoot. That was basically the idea. In the Beis HaMikdash, you have to go barefoot. So it seems intrinsically barefoot is considered to be more desirable. That's right. And that, well, that's why the Jews from the Jews in Arab countries pray the same way. This is where you get into the whole issue of dress codes, which is I don't want to address. But the issue of one of the aspects of a dress code is that when it comes to davening, there are special halachas. So even if theoretically somebody could wear whatever they want during the classroom day, but then you'd have to have another uniform to put on for davening. So hence, there is certain halachic compulsion towards dressing a certain way. For that
what
alone.
About duchening?
It's a good example. It's a very good example. Yeah. Duchening is a service that was done in the Beis HaMikdash. Mm-hmm. And in the Beis HaMikdash, Kohanim were barefoot. And that's right, and that's why you do it barefoot, because that's the one avoda of the Beis HaMikdash that we still do today. Ephraim, Yeshua is from Ephraim.
Gilead
is Menashe. So, and they're both called Na'arim, and therefore that they saw in the appearance of the angel a fulfillment of Yivarech Es Hana'arim. The Malach would be Yivarech Es Hana'arim. Okay. Now here we're going to read about the downfall of Yericho. Yericho is the very first city in Eretz Yisrael. Just as a point of information, in Tefillah, we have one prayer that we recite that was composed by Yehoshua in honor of the downfall of Yericho. That is the famous prayer, Aleinu L'Shabeach. Aleinu L'Shabeach, the first paragraph, until Alkei Nekaveh. There's another author for Alkei Nekaveh in a second. The first part of Aleinu was composed by Yehoshua as a song of thanksgiving to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the downfall of Yericho, which was a sign that they would conquer the rest of Eretz Yisrael. It's a little unfortunate, you know, that Aleinu we recite three times a day. So we say it very quickly and we don't really think about it. Really, Aleinu was originally recited only once a year, twice a year. It was recited in the Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. It's the same Aleinu. Mm-hmm. And it was such an elevated prayer that they later decided to say it every day. So it's the opposite. It's not something that's just really quick. It was so kadosh. Just like Anam Zemiros is another example. Anam Zemiros, in many congregations, is only said on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That's the hymn of glory describing the Shekhinah in very, very graphic terms. Many people felt you shouldn't say it every Shabbos because that demeans it a little bit. I know people who are critical. I'm not, but I mean, there are people who are critical of having a child below bar mitzvah say Anam Zemiros, because it is really a very, very holy prayer. One could counter that maybe children are holier than adults because they don't yet have Averis. Okay. But Aleinu, it is said, now this is kind of a shvach a little bit, but you know that when songs are composed or tefillos are composed, very often the author's name is supposed to be hinted at in the prayer. Like if you look at the Shabbos Semiros, the letter will spell out the author's name. So some want to say that in the Aleinu, we can see a remes to Yehoshua's name backwards. Just like a little bit of Siddur. Yeshua did it backwards, so you wouldn't be able to figure out that it's Yeshua's name. And that's why it actually isn't a very good acrostic, but you can pierce it out. Also, he doesn't use the name Yehoshua. He uses his natural name, Hosea. Remember, Yehoshua's name was Hosea. Moshe added a yud to say, may Hashem protect you from the meraglim. So if you look at Aleinu, so we have to have, if you do Hosea backwards, you have Ayin, Shin, Vav, and Hey. So you get that in Aleinu. Just find it. Of course, Aleinu begins with Ayin. Shaloh asanu yeheretzah. So you say Aleinu, that's sentence number one. Shaloh asanu yeheretzos. Again, it's asymmetrical. That's sentence number two. Vilo samanu kushbechos hadama is sentence number three. And now you have to have a hey. Where do you get a hey? I'm trying to remember. Hu Elokeinu, I think. But again, what you're dealing with is you're dealing with such an asymmetrical acrostic. Like, you know, the first one is two phrases. The second one is one phrase. Then you have like six phrases. But you do get a Hosea that is said. But anyway, Chazal don't make the acrostic argument, but they do say that Yehoshua ben Nun was the composer of the prayer of Aleinu. Now, the second paragraph of Aleinu.
What was the hey?
The hey is Hu Elokeinu, A nodes. Okay. Right. No, I guess you could find, you know, you could probably find, you know, five other names.
Why can't you just take the first Hu Elokeinu?
No, Aleinu Lisha Beach Lado.
It's as good as the other one.
Oh. Third, well, let's see. The first letter of the first word. The second letter. The second letter of the second word. No, third letter. Vav. Okay, you don't count the lamed. You don't count the lamed. Adam. The third letter of the third word.
No, you don't have a hey. Hey, hey, you got it.
Okay. All right. Well, he did try to disguise his authorship. So as an act of humility, he tried to disguise his authorship. Now, the second paragraph is even more. I read a little ahead of myself that there was this man Achan. Now, Yeshua made a rule that nobody is allowed to take of the spoils of Yericho. We'll discuss why he made such a rule. Achan was the one who took the spoils. And because of this, the Jewish people were defeated at a battle in Ai, and when eventually Achan was discovered, Achan was sentenced to death. But it says, before he was sentenced to death, he did Shuvah, and he composed a song to Hashem. And that is, the Alkei Nekave is Achan. That's Aleph Kaf Nun. So actually, Achan himself was a Chozer B'Tshuva before his death, and he composed this particular song. No, because you can't escape a death penalty by being chazir tshuva. If a person is sentenced to death, every person who was killed is supposed to do tshuva before he dies, and this is is the final kapara for a person. You can't escape a death sentence chas v'shalom by just doing tshuva at that time.
But so, you can be forgiven by God.
Yeah, Hashem forgives you. We can never gauge tshuva. So Achan actually composed this hymn. Now it is interesting because Aleinu was a martyrdom song. Unfortunately, in the Holocaust, people tended not to have time to say long things, but in the Middle Ages, with Crusades and the like, very often Aleinu was actually said by people before they would be killed. And it's interesting that Achan himself, before he was killed, had this song Aleinu. Okay. So we do have, so the downfall of Yericho is with us to the very day. Now, also, if I can go ahead a little bit, if you look at the end of Perek Vav, I just want to show you something else that applies today. It was after the downfall of Yericho, and we'll discuss the process. Pasuk Chaf Vav says this, Vayashpa Yehoshua Ba'isahin Lamor. Yehoshua imposed an oath the day of Yericho's downfall that says, Oror ha'ish lifnei Hashem. Cursed is the person in the presence of God. We're all in the presence of God. So in effect, every person is cursed. Asher yakum uvana es ha'ir hazos es yiricha. Who shall reestablish and build up this city, Yiricha. And the curse is this. Bibchoro yiyastena. When he makes the foundations, he shall make the foundation with his firstborn, which means his firstborn child shall die when he begins to build the city. Uvitziiro, and with his youngest son, Yatsiv Gulasehi, will put the final gates. That's the final touches. Which means the curse is, anyone that tries to build up this city will lose all of his children in chronological sequence. He will lose his first son when he begins. He will lose his last son when he finishes. 500 years later, in the book of Malachim, it describes a man, Chiel, that's a short form of Yechiel, who tried to rebuild Yericha, and indeed, the Pasuk tells us this curse was fulfilled. He lost all of his children. Chazal say one thing, you'll notice the repetition. Who builds Esoir Azos, this city, Es Yericha, Jericho. Why does it say both? So Chazal say there are two prohibitions. One is to rebuild the city on its original site, whatever you call it, even if you call it New York, and the other is to build another city that you call Yericha, even if you build it elsewhere. Now, again, obviously there are questions. We do have a city that is called Yericho today. Now, some say, which is not what I just said, some would say that it's only usher to build Yericho on its original. that's a separate issue. And Hashem didn't want Jericho to be built because Hashem basically wanted the remnants of those walls to remain there so that everybody would see the whole miracle. Now you'll recall...
What's the contemporary number from Jews?
Well, you're allowed to live in Jericho. Remember, Yeshua did not prohibit living in Jericho. Yeshua prohibited building up Jericho. But again, it's still a kind of an undefined prohibition. What does it mean to build up Jericho? Does that mean if I build a house in Jericho, I've committed an aveira, or is it only if I'm the developer who builds the whole city? Right? I mean, it's not really clear. But as I say, most poskim say today that given the fact that the present site of Jericho is not Jericho, it's nearby, but it isn't the same, given the fact that Chiel already built up the city, given the fact that the original walls that were that fell are no longer visible anyway, so there are a lot of factors that would be permitted today. Because you've already destroyed, or at least covered up, the remnants of the original miracle. Okay.
And haven't they unearthed a lot
They've unearthed a lot of it, yeah. And that's
so
around,
you can't really say that it's not visible, because they've succeeded in unearthing a lot of them, and maybe the mitzvah is being fulfilled by the fact that they have unearthed the original city, and then you can't really... But it depends what
but
you
But on the other hand,
say,
that wouldn't be on the site.
Yeah, if you say the Easter includes the other site. I mean, if the Chazal say it's ever...
Okay, but it's interesting.
The problem.
Yeah, it's interesting. That some people say, though, that the reason why it's Usher on the other site to call it Jericho is because people might think that was the original site, which indicates if it's known that that's not the original site, maybe there is no Easter. So you have that situation. Okay, but in any event, this is a halacha that theoretically applies today, but its actual application isn't very clear. I don't believe there are any Jews who live in Jericho currently. You never know. I mean, you never know, because just like, you know, you can go to a slum that used to be a Jewish neighborhood, you can always find like one or two Jews who are still around. I wonder when I go into these Arab cities, you know, does there happen to be some old Jew who lives there? You know, you don't really know.
But
there is intermarriage, that's true. There is, that is actually a serious problem in Israel. People don't talk about it too much. Okay, anyway, the way Jericho fell is very special, and it has a remnant to the way we do it today, certain mitzvahs we do today. You recall that Hashem commanded Yoshua that seven Kohanim would be blowing seven shofros, and they would be in front of the Aron HaKodesh. And actually what you have is this, and the chalutz are the soldiers in readiness, would be in front of the Kohanim. So you have chalutzim, I'll describe who they are in a second, Kohanim who are blowing shofros, the Aron HaKodesh, and then the ma'aseif, there were people who were in the back rows, these are really from the tribe of Dan, and they were making a procession around Jericho, and they were told to walk around Jericho once every day, and on the seventh day, walk around Jericho seven times. And Chazal say that this corresponded to the week, that the first day was Sunday, and the seventh day, Jericho actually fell on Shabbos. And when they walked around Jericho seven times, blowing the shofar, at that point, all of the Jewish people should shout, and when they shouted, the wall of Jericho fell down. Now, there is really a machlokas. It didn't topple down. The reason is because Jericho's wall was a cube. So a cube, right, let's say a cube, if a cube falls on its side, let's say it was 10 feet high and 10 feet wide. So if a 10 foot high wall simply falls, so the width becomes the height. So Jericho's wall did not just fall down, Jericho's wall crumbled or sank. There are two versions, either it sank or it crumbled. There is a machlokas if all the walls of Jericho crumbled on all four sides, or only the wall right in front of them. Because remember, Rachav Hazona lived in a wall, in a house that was built into the wall. Now, if all the walls fell, how could they go get Rachav? So some say Rachav was on another wall, and her house was safe, but the wall in front of them collapsed. Now, first of all, it is significant that the Mapala of Jericho occurred on Shabbos. Now, there was Chilul Shabbos involved here. All right, blowing the shofar is not a malacha d'oraisa. The raisa of blowing the shofar. In other words, we don't blow a shofar in Rosh Hashanah because the rabbis made a decree, lest you carry it. It's not a Torah prohibition. But certainly carrying the ark and everything else was a malacha on Shabbos. But the general rule is, milchames mitzvah, the obligatory wars of conquering Eretz Yisrael, can be done even on Shabbos, and Hashem said to do it on Shabbos. Now, there is a remnant to the notion of Yericho even today, and it's interesting. On Sukkos, we just had Sukkos. And every day of Sukkos, at least the men, walk around the Bima, with the Lulav and the Esrog, does the Hoshanas. And Hoshana Rabbah, which is the seventh day, we walk around seven times. Now, the original din was, this was only done in the Beis HaMikdash. It was the Beis HaMikdash, they would walk around the altar with these very big aravos. They wouldn't walk with the lulav. They had gigantic aravos. They had aravos which were 11 amos high. An amos, 2 feet. 22 feet high aravos from a place called Motza. Motza is a suburb of Yerushalayim, which still produces beautiful aravos. And they would walk around the Mizbeach once. On Hoshana Rabbah, the day of the great Hoshana, we walk around seven times. Bisman Hazeh, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, so to commemorate what they did in the Beis HaMikdash, we do it around the Bima. But what's interesting is this. Chazal see that the whole Hoshana ceremony is reminiscent of the downfall of Yericho. But just like Yericho was, you walked around once every day, and seven times on Shabbos, you do so for Hoshanas as well. What's the connection? So there's a lot of connections. I should also call to your attention, keep in mind, the Hakafos of Simchas Torah, where, again, we dance, we kind of forget what exactly you're supposed to do, but what you're supposed to do is, and we do this before we begin dancing, is the Bima must be walked around once, and we do this seven times. We have seven Hakafos. But let me first talk about the Arava ceremony. Everyone knows the famous Medrash, what all the different species represent, right? The Lulav represents, or the Esrog represents, those who have fragrance and taste. Those are the people who do Chesed and learn Torah. And Lulav, which has fruit but no smell, represents those who have Torah but not Masim Tovim. And the Hadas, which has a smell, are those who have Masim Tovim and not Torah. And the Arava, the lowly Arava, is the person that has nothing. And to some extent, therefore, Arava represents what you might call the refuse of the world, the psolus of the world, the evil in the world. And indeed, during Sukkos, we take everything to try to bring everybody together. But in the Hoshana ceremony, part of what we're praying for is that the evil, the powers of evil in the world, the powers of sin, should be gradually diminished and defeated. And just like Yericho, which epitomized, Yericho was the most powerful city in Eretz Israel. Yericho was also a center of idolatry. It was kind of a major religious center in the country. And the way we diminish the powers of evil, just as there, we walked around it once, and every time we walk around it, we contain it more, we restrain it more, we weaken it more, till finally comes the seventh day where we're able to topple it. So too with the Arava, we walk around with the Arava seven times, and Rosh Hashanah Rabbah seven times, to affirm the eventual vanquishment of evil. Also, on a positive note, we say that the walking around, encircling something is very symbolic in a lot of ways. To encircle something is to contain it. But the containment can be a few things. You can try to contain a disease, contain something bad, limit it. But containing is also to envelop it in a positive sense. For example, a kala walks around her chasan. There are a few customs, but the primary custom is seven times. Because the kala, as it were, protects the chasan. The kala can create an environment, creates a home for the chasan, where the chasan will be able to accomplish what he's able to accomplish. It's very interesting. We perceive... Sorry, didn't hear. That might be true too. It's interesting. It's a very interesting idea because we look at we commonly look at the man as protecting the women, right? You protect the women folk. In Chazal, we find the opposite idea. We find the notion of a woman protects a man. Not in the physical sense necessarily, but in the spiritual sense of creating an environment, creating a bias where the man is able to do what has to be done. So part of the surrounding idea is to protect and preserve, but part of the surrounding is also to contain and restrict. So we have the Yericho idea, is the walking around, as it were, to let those powers of evil get gradually weaker and weaker and weaker, until it finally falls. And that's the idea of the Arava. That's why you take it with the Arava, because the Arava does represent the power of evil in the world. However, we find that Hakafa, walking around, destroys walls, destroys barriers. It destroyed this barrier. And in a sense, therefore, the Hakafos, both of the Arava type and of the Simchas Torah type, destroy the wall that separates us. We talk about a wall that's between us and Hashem. It destroys the Mechita. And in fact, you can look at it this way. Really, one way of looking at it is, this might be the difference between the Hakafos of the 7 days of Sukkos and the Hakafos of Simchas Torah. And that is, the Hakafos of Sukkos is to contain the evil and diminish it and get rid of it. And the Hakafos of Simchas Torah is when we break down the walls that divide us from Hashem, so we can achieve that total unity with Hashem. But first we have to weaken the evil within ourselves, as it were. So all of this is connected to Yericho. Yericho, the falling of the wall of Yericho has a double dimension. It represents the defeat of evil, but it also represents the diminishing of the barriers between the Jewish people and Hashem. Tefillin is another example. The tefillin is wrapped around the arm seven times. We surround ourselves seven times by the tefillin, and part of that is the tefillin symbolically is Hashem connecting himself to us. Tefillin is a form of marriage. Again, all right. So all of this is connected. I mean, the source of all of these ideas, the tefillin is seven times, the kala walking around the chasan seven times, the aravas and the mikdash seven times, and even the hakavas of Simchas Torah are connected to this ceremony of the downfall of the wall of Yericho. One little halachic problem I mentioned, that they are told here to blow the shofar. The ark is walking around with them, and they blow kohanim. Seven kohanim blow. I'm sorry. Yeah, that's an excellent question. The Rambam says very clearly, and it's based on statements in the Gemara, that even before we wage war against the obligatory nations of Canaan that we're supposed to eradicate, we have to offer them shalom. Now, shalom doesn't mean just a peace treaty. Shalom is fairly tight. Shalom means they have to accept the seven commandments of Noah, and they have to acknowledge Jewish sovereignty. In other words, if they do those two conditions, they are allowed to remain in Eretz Yisrael. Even the Shiva Umos, even Amalek, there is called the mitzvah of Kriyas Shalom. And in fact, the Yushalmi says, before Yoshua even entered Eretz Yisrael, he sent a message to all of the cities offering them three choices. He says, if you want to leave, you can leave. If you want to acknowledge sovereignty and the seven commandments, you can do that. Or if not, we're going to fight. So all of these cities were given advance notice. Now, the Girgashi, you find that we have seven nations. And very often, only six of them are mentioned. There's a nation, Girgashi, that is very often not mentioned. And Chazal say that is because the Girgashi did flee, and they went to Africa. We don't know exactly who they are, but Yoshua did offer this Kriyas Shalom. And we're going to discuss this, because this explains a lot of things. This explains, for example, how could Rachav be kept alive? If Rachav is one of the seven nations, the Torah says you have to kill the seven nations, women, men, women, and children. How could Yeshua marry Rachav? Yeshua married Rachav.
The answer is
that Rachav, who became a Gioris, he actually saw that she was very, very righteous. I don't know if you, I may have mentioned this, Shulamit Aloni started a brief campaign in honor of Rachav Hazona. She wanted to say, how come people go to Kever Rachel and they don't go to the Kever of Rachav Hazona? She's part of Jewish history too. So she meant to say, she didn't mean because Rachel was a tzaddikus who converted. She meant because, you know, we have prostitutes and other people that we ought to glorify or whatever. So in effect, many of the religious saw that as an insult to Rachav, because Rachav did do tshuva and she converted and everything else. So they actually started saying, well, we ought to visit, you know, the kever of Rachav Hazona, because she was a tzaddikus. You also recall, Targum Yonason ben Uziel always uses the euphemism. He uses zona to mean mezonos. She was an innkeeper. Balas Pumbikis. Although, Mustam, Chazal took it literally. I mean, he did it that way that people shouldn't think poorly of her. But in point of fact, even the pundakisa, even the innkeeper, was also a zone in the other sense. So it's not necessarily exclusive interpretations. Yeah, so the answer is there is a mitzvah of kriyas shalom. The Rambam's opinion is this mitzvah applies even after they cross the Yarden. See, Tosfos has an opinion that the opportunity for making shalom only applied before the Jewish people crossed the Yarden. Once they crossed, it was too late. And Rachav was able to get in under the wire because Rachav, you know, negotiated with the spies before the rest of the people crossed over. The Rambam says that's not true. At any point in time, any individual or group of people could say, they don't have to become Jewish, we accept the seven commandments of Noah.
Was Shaul given a chance to say, tell Aga, to give him that choice afterwards? I mean, why was he punished?
Amalek might be different. I might have misspoken. The Rambam is talking about the seven nations of Canaan. Amalek has the option of Judaism, according to Rashi's opinion. But they don't have... Yes. In fact, we find the grandchildren of Haman became Shemai of Avtalion. That's right. But they don't have the option of just accepting the seven commandments.
Oh, so the Amalek is different in the fact that they can only convert to Judaism or be...
Right.
The Machot Simcheh doesn't apply because once they become Jews...
They sever that connection. That's right. Now, what about marriage? Marriage is really another issue, though, because, in other words, Kriyas Shalom enables you to keep them alive. And that's why you find, you're going to find throughout Tanakh that there are pockets of Canaanim in Eretz Yisrael and Amorim in Eretz Yisrael. You're going to find pockets. Why didn't they get rid of them? Because they were Makabel Shalom. They agreed to live as a Ger Toshav. This is a Ger Toshav in Eretz Yisrael. And that is possible. But of course, obviously, accepting the seven commandments of Noach does not permit you to marry them. You can't marry a guy. So there you need geirus. You need actual conversion. Now, there is a machlokas. If the prohibition of marrying the seven nations, can that prohibition of marriage go off when they convert to Judaism? Los eschatein. The Torah says, los eschatein. You may not marry them. So some say that must refer to when they've already become Jewish. Because when they're goyim, you can't have a chasna with them anyway. So it must be saying, even after they convert, you cannot marry them. Of course, then you have a question. How could Yehoshua marry Rachav? And then we have to posit, well, Rachav lived in Yericho, but she, you know, perhaps she was not from the seven nations. She may have been somewhere else. Other people learn, no, Los Ischatin refers only to when they're goyim. It's a prohibition on intermarriage. And once they convert, it's permitted. And we'll discuss this in further detail. So you do have machlokas regarding los eschatein, and you do have a machlokas regarding the idea, the option of kriyat shalom, offering peace, that according to the Rambam, this is at any time they could escape annihilation by accepting the seven commandments and Jewish sovereignty, two conditions, by the way. According to Tosfos, only before Yehoshua crossed the Yarden did they have that option. Sorry, question?
Right.
Well, that's right. They really don't know what's going on. These people have this silent march, well, except for the shofar blowing, walking around and around and around, and the wall just falls. And we are told that it did have a tremendous effect. It made the rest of conquering Eretz Israel much, much easier as a result. Okay. I guess we'll finish up next week. I just want to mention one more thing. Recall that Yehoshua did, in fact, say that all of the... This is unique to Yericho. It did not apply to any other city. That all of the spoils of the city, the animals have to be killed, and the gold and the silver and the precious metals have to be given to the Beis HaMikdash. No one is allowed to take any property for themselves. This is unique. This is not a general rule. It is true that, what does the Torah say? It is true the Torah says any objects that are used for idolatry must be destroyed.
If a guy invalidates it, then you can use it for Hanag.
That is true. But this had nothing to do with that, because this prohibited even objects that were not used for Avodah Zarah. So where did Yehoshua get this idea? Because it doesn't say Hashem told Yehoshua this. Some say that it might be inferred from the angel's communication. When the angel's communication says, this land is holy, you might infer everything is usher. But that's not, you know, it depends on how you interpret that phrase, this land is holy. So, but most opinions say Yeshua did this on his own, and Hashem agreed with him after the fact, because Achan was put to death, but it was Yeshua's own idea. So why did Yeshua have such an idea? So the Medrash gives a few reasons. One reason is a very interesting idea, that since the destruction of Yericho took place on Shabbos, it was not proper for people to make a personal profit out of Malacha that was done on Shabbos. Because, you know, Hashem says you can desecrate Shabbos for a mitzvah, but you don't desecrate Shabbos to make money. And therefore, the concept was, whatever, this happened on Shabbos, therefore no profit. Others see it as Yeshua takes the analogy of challah. When you make a dough, so you have to take part of the dough and give it to Hashem first. You have grain, you have to give the first fruits. Right, the concept of giving the first of everything to Hashem. A firstborn has kedusha, a firstborn animal, even a firstborn human being, you have to redeem. The first of your produce you give as truma. This is the first of their acquisitions in Eretz Yisrael. So you give it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. A third explanation is, although this is not totally halachically consistent, is the Torah does have an institution called Ir HaNidachas. Ir HaNidachas is a city the majority of whose inhabitants have worshipped idols. So the Torah says, an Ir HaNidachas not only must be totally destroyed, but all of its property should be destroyed. In fact, even the people who didn't worship. The people who didn't worship get to escape. They don't get killed, but their property gets destroyed. Because all property in Ir HaNidachas must get destroyed. But once again, Yericho might be called an Ir HaNidachas, but halakhically that doesn't work for a lot of reasons. Number one, Yeshua didn't say destroy everything. Yeshua said give the gold and silver to Hashem. That is not what you do with an Ir HaNidachas. Number two, the institution of Ir HaNidachas applies to a Jewish city. I mean, every city in Canaan could have been an Ir HaNidachas in that sense. Every city had a majority of idol worshippers, but there was no halacha that says destroy those cities. So the Ir HaNidachas analogy just doesn't fit because here property was not destroyed, only it was given to Hashem, and also it could have applied to other cities as well. There's a fourth reason, it's an interesting reason that it says, that Yericho was the only city that was destroyed by an open manifestation of a miracle, as opposed to war. And there is a principle that one should try to avoid deriving personal benefit from miracles. The reason is because since a miracle is a supernatural thing, as it were, so that diminishes from your reward in Olam Haba. Because Olam Haba is otherworldly and miracles are otherworldly, and you derive some benefit of that. Of course, there is a kasha with that because by Kriyas Yamsuf, by the splitting of the Red Sea, the Jewish people took a lot of wealth from the Egyptians. You don't find an analogous prohibition there. But some city of Barbanel suggests that since Yericho is Masa Nisan, it is forbidden to benefit from Masa Nisan. But in either event, Barbanel says that. But in either event, we do find, according to most interpretations, this was Yehoshua's own decree, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu agreed with Yehoshua's decree. And that's why we find that somebody who violated that decree, Achad, was put to death for violating that. Okay, but we'll talk about it next week. There was a Muhammad, that's true. But the point is that B'derech HaTeva, the Jewish people would have been unable to breach the wall. And therefore, in effect... So that's an argument among the Meforshim, what happened. The wall surrounded the whole city, but some say only one side of the wall crumbled, and Rachav was in one of the other walls. Some say everything crumbled, and Rachav managed to go somewhere else beforehand.
So the wall in essence destroyed some people, but not the wall.
That's right. The wall did not destroy the city of Yericho, other than maybe some people, but the wall enabled them to go into the city. Right.
Thank
you. That's right. But that's Milchames Mitzvah, which you're allowed to wage on Shabbos. It's an obligatory war to conquer Eretz Yisrael. You're allowed to wage that war on Shabbos.
That's right.
Well, it's as if they needed the holiness of Shabbos to give them the ability to surmount Yericho. They needed the Kedusha of Shabbos to help them pay.
Hi.
questions.
Yeah.